So can you just start by saying your name and your affiliation?
Yes, I'm Paul Harrison. I'm a professor of psychiatry at the University of Oxford. I'm also a consultant general adult psychiatrist.
And first of all, can you just tell me a little bit about yourself? How did you briefly get to be where you are now?
So I had a fairly conventional academic medical training. So I trained in Oxford and in London, had a Wellcome Senior Fellowship, and I was appointed my current chair, which is the reader position in psychiatry, back in the late 1990s, and I've been here ever since. And until COVID came along, my main research interest was into serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And I've done a range of different sorts of research study broadly within the biological end of the psychiatric research field.
Mm-hmm. And if there's one overarching question that gets you out of bed in the morning, what would you say it was?
I think it's trying to understand the biological basis of serious mental illness and how we can use that information to treat the conditions better.
And so what techniques have you mostly used to explore that question?
Well, over the years I've done everything from post-mortem neuropathology, structural and functional brain imaging, experimental medicine, clinical trials. So I've dabbled in a range of methodologies from the very basic molecular science through to, say, clinical trials of patients.
But it's very much at the biological end.
Yes, it is.
You don't meet the conventional picture of what people think of when they think of a psychiatrist.
I suppose that's probably true. I mean, remembering, of course, psychiatry is as much a medical specialty as haematology or oncology. I think you're right. A lot of both lay and some other medical people think of us not really as doctors, but if you like, as psychologists or therapists. I'm very much of the camp that first and foremost sees myself as a doctor and ascribe to all the values and beliefs of doctors, and I just happen to be applying it to conditions we call psychiatric.
So moving on to COVID itself, can you remember when you first became aware that there was a pandemic in the offing?
Yes, I do. I was skiing in northern Italy just at the time when cases
were.
I was there about 4 weeks before I think it got really serious out there. But yes, I remember talking to my wife on the holiday saying, gosh, do you think this is going to spread? Is this going to be another, like a bird flu or a previous MERS sort of virus? It'll all peter out. But it was beginning to look worrying then. And then, of course, within weeks of being home, we were into the full realisation what was going to happen and the government deciding what it was or wasn't going to do about it.
And how soon was it before you thought, this is something I need to pivot my research towards? And I mean, was there an external push for that, or did that just come from talking to your colleagues?
I think my recollection of course, the priority at that time was just how are we going to cope with the pandemic and the lockdown. So I had both kind of coping with the practical restrictions that were being imposed on us as individuals and as members of the university, the labs closing, etc., etc. Perhaps my second or my main thought was, as a doctor, how is this going to affect what I should be doing? Because I think in the very early stages, when the fear that we were going to be completely overwhelmed in the NHS, a number of us, even as psychiatrists, were thinking about, should we be going to offer our services to the accident department? Should we be offering to go and learn how to man ventilators? Some fairly scary thoughts for us and for our potential patients, I can assure you. But then, whilst that was happening, and as it became more apparent that level of repositioning our clinical work wasn't going to happen, we began to think more, how can we as psychiatrists help deal with the mental health consequences of lockdown as well as of COVID infection itself? And so the work over the coming months, I'm talking now kind of spring to summer 2020, my clinical work very much moved in part to looking after people who'd had COVID and dealing with their mental health sequelae, but also thinking, how can we use our research opportunities and the time that's been made free because our previous studies have had to stop, try and use some of our academic abilities to try and answer some of the important questions that were becoming apparent.
So let's just go back and unpack some of that. So first of all, the impact of the measures that were taken, the closing of departments and so on. Mm. I mean, patients don't stop being ill. How did you cope with that?
Yes, so again, in the beginning, I think we were unclear how much the mental health services are going to be overwhelmed, and indeed how much the inpatients on the psychiatric hospital here were going to be affected with COVID, and we were going to be turned into almost a medical extension of the John Radcliffe Hospital. So I remember for about a 6 week period, we were on daily calls with the hospital management, looking at numbers of cases, how many staff were going off sick, how could you keep the wards open, how could we as honorary consultants help the mental health trust efforts to keep clinical services going and adapt them to what was thought to be a change in the kinds of patients and the kind of problems they're going to have. So there was a lot of kind of detailed attention to try and make plans that were going to keep the service going under what were difficult circumstances, and there were some fairly, you know, cataclysmic predictions of how bad it was going to get before we realised it wasn't going to be quite that awful. And then gradually over the months, as the reality sort of settled down, it became clear what was a problem and what wasn't, we gradually went back more towards our normal ways of working within the constraints of the pandemic.
Mm. So was there much of a problem of infection in the patients in the ward for care?
Yes, I think all the acute wards had an outbreak, as you might expect, of some patients, and the main problem was the staff going off. And of course, this was before the vaccines were around, and quite a lot of the staff in this hospital were from the more vulnerable communities and population. So that was a real challenge, I think, for the hospital management to keep the wards open and safely staffed. But that obviously gradually got better as things settled down and as the vaccines came on.
And did you experience, moving on to the second half of what you said, did you experience an increase in people with mental health difficulties as a result of COVID infection?
Yes, but I think, again, less than we were expecting at the beginning, and that was partly because, for example, the Trust put in a 24/7 phone helpline, so recognising the fact that most people couldn't or wouldn't come on site. Another thing the pandemic's done for my area of medicine is it's transformed the views about the importance of face-to-face as opposed to remote assessments, and that change happened really remarkably quickly and surprisingly effortlessly. It was a lot of technological questions, but it's been much less problematic, I think, both us as practitioners and most of our patients, and I think we would have thought, and kind of jumping ahead to where we are now, it's already leading to changes, I think, about how we envisage psychiatry being practiced in the future, where then kind of the assumption that you need to be in the same room with someone every single time you're assessing them. I don't think any of us think we're quite going to go back to that. We're trying to work out what's the right compromise, what flexibility should we offer. So I think that'll be one of the more interesting positive outcomes of the pandemic. It's forced change upon us, which otherwise I think we'd have been dragged screaming towards, and actually it's worked out fine in most respects.
But what kind of problems did people who'd had the disease present?
Well, I mean, at the beginning, especially when case numbers were low, it wasn't really people who'd had COVID so much, because they were still rare enough that they were individual patients of interest that people noticed. It was really how were the population coping with lockdown and the fear of illness and the what was going to happen after lockdown. Would they have lost their job? Would they lose their parents? They couldn't visit. All the kind of real stuff that we all went through. And it was really helping the worried well, or the people who wondered about the implication of the pandemic. It was only later, as the number of confirmed cases grew, that the suggestion there might be a link between actually having the infection and getting mental health problems became more apparent, and that's really where my particular research interest in the pandemic developed from.
So how easy was it to identify the kind of research questions you might explore? Bring them into some kind of focus. How did you know where to start?
Okay, so in parallel with all that, you're trying to keep the clinical service going and all the other stuff we within the department here, where there's a lot of academics and most of whose research has essentially stopped, we had a number of Zoom meetings where we all kind of thought about where could we make a difference, where are the opportunities that we can take advantage of whatever connections, skills we have. And so a number of my colleagues really set off really, I think, what have been leading programmes in the kind of mental health of COVID in different areas. My own interest was really fortuitous. I took advantage of a fortunate coincidence. Because my main work has been lab-based, and that couldn't happen, by chance, a few months before the pandemic began, I'd started working on a big electronic health records network, mostly in the US, but in other parts of the world as well. And I remember distinctly suddenly having one of those light bulb moments. Well, hang on, there are 80 million patients in this data set, and they're recording pretty much in real time diagnosis of COVID. And the first time I went to this database, which must have been early summer 2020, there were already about 50,000 people there who had a diagnosis of COVID. So again, you didn't really have to be very bright to think, hang on, now I can use these data to say what risks are those 50,000 patients at in the coming weeks and months in terms of the mental health diagnoses. I could compare the people who've had COVID with people who've had other health events like flu or broken leg. And similarly, I could say, to what extent does having a previous psychiatric history affect your risks of getting COVID? So it was taking advantage of electronic health records and the fact I had, by chance, started working with them that gave us the opportunity to say, okay, let's try and get some robust real-world data on the incidences and the risks of the common mental health conditions using this network.
So tell me a bit more about the network. I mean, I know about UK Biobank, and that's 500,000 people, but you're talking about much, much larger numbers. And how did that network get put together?
Well, so it's got a federated health network. It happens to be, it has its proprietary name. It happens to be called Trinetics, in case anyone's interested. And in fact, there are two or three of these in the States now, particularly, which between them cover the majority of the American population. And they do it because they're partly because they're collecting health data because of the way that you pay for healthcare in the US. So all the healthcare providers have to be fairly organised, and about 60 or 70 of the big healthcare providers scattered across the US upload their data anonymised to this electronic health records network. And the reason they set it up was because pharmaceutical companies wanted to know, where can I find the patients with the following characteristics? Because I want to do a clinical trial of a new drug, for example, or whatever else. And so they would pay the network for access to these data to find out where they would go to recruit their patients. A couple of years ago, the network realised that actually this kind of information could be quite useful academically for nothing. I've got no interest in drug development in this regard at all. And so for reasons I can go into if you're interested, I at Oxford was, I think, the first academic anywhere in the world to be given unrestricted and free access to this network.
Wow.
I think because the network saw the value, if someone like me could demonstrate how useful their data were for academics, they might in the future, I imagine, want to make academics pay for access, like you do for many other big data sets. And so we had been working with this network, and I kind of learned how to use it before COVID came along, which is why I say I was very fortunate to them to be in a position not only to know how to ask the questions, but have access to what I think was, at the time, probably still is, the biggest single electronic health records network in the world.
So what was the first question that you posed?
Yeah, so given the time, and I should acknowledge at this point that all the work, if we're going to talk about the work that's happened subsequently, has really been driven by a junior psychiatrist called Max Takei, who's a trainee who, again, happened to have an extraordinary skill set that meant he was able not only to interrogate this network like I could, but he could do some much more sophisticated things, and he's kind of managed to reverse engineer some analyses. So he has enabled us to do quite sophisticated approaches rather than simply counting bodies, if you like. So given the time, we're talking last summer 2020, so the epidemic was kind of 3 or 4 months in, and I say we had 60 or so thousand patients with COVID by the time we did the definitive analysis. We simply asked the question, in 3 months after a diagnosis of COVID, what percent of those patients have been given a diagnosis of any of the common psychiatric conditions, depression, anxiety, psychosis, and so on? And similarly, what were your risks of COVID if you had a psychiatric diagnosis beforehand than if you didn't? And so essentially that our first paper was the numbers, the percentages, as well as the comparison with other health conditions to show that you were more likely to get a psychiatric diagnosis after COVID than you were after anything else we compared COVID to, and importantly, having matched the patients for all their other characteristics. So we did what we could to rule out the non-specific to allow us to answer the question, how much of this is really about COVID itself, as opposed to just being ill or indeed living through the pandemic?
And the numbers, the sheer numbers in this network.
Yes,
it gave must us, have meant that all that was extremely reliable.
Yeah, exactly. It was very, so the statistics, of course, you get statistics you die for in smaller samples. And but another way of saying that, the confidence intervals were very tight. So they were very precise estimates. So we could say, I forget the exact numbers, but for example, something like a first episode of depression occurred in 4.8% of patients. And we were pretty sure it was between 4.7 and 4.9. So these were really, I think, the first good data, with the limitations of health records data, but they were about as good data as you could have had for that point in the pandemic. And I think probably because of that paper got picked up, but it began remarkably by the media in a way, I've never experienced my research career, not because it was spectacular research, but it was such a pressing question that the world's media wanted answers to, and we gave some of the first answers.
And those answers presumably are highly relevant to how clinical services are delivered and what, so both care and health services are delivered in the future.
You would think so. Again, in the beginning, I'm not sure that was really the interest, because again, the numbers of people who are getting COVID were so small, people were still more interested in what's the whole population's mental health going to be. But yes, our data and the subsequent papers we've done, I think, do highlight that whatever the pandemic has done to all of our mental health, it's done something worse or greater to the people who've been unfortunate enough to get COVID itself. And that's become, I say, more apparent, I think, as the pandemic has progressed.
So that was the first study. Mm. Made a little list here. Oh, I think we did. Oh, yes, you said you were also interested in whether having a previous diagnosis,
yes,
of mental health difficulties increased your chances of getting...
Yes, now, that was really very much a kind of a speculative thing. I remember just thinking, well, while we're doing one question, why don't we answer the other? Because it's kind of a lot of the work is the same. I don't think I really had a particular prediction or hypothesis. And we did find in this paper that if you had a previous diagnosis of something like depression or anxiety or schizophrenia, you were almost, I think, two-thirds more likely to have got COVID by the time we did the study than matched people who didn't have a mental health disorder. So we thought, wow, that's quite striking. Interestingly, the week before we published, in another big electronic health records network, another group found exactly the same, if not an even more striking effect. So by the time our paper came out, both the big studies were both agreeing that there was a connection between your mental health and your risk of COVID. Lots of speculation about what the mechanism might be, and I have to say we haven't really drilled down much further into that, but certainly it was that fact was one of the reasons, I believe, why the government prioritised patients with serious mental illness in the original vaccine rollouts, because of evidence that was presented at the House of Commons. I believe that our data had suggested these were a vulnerable population. So that was quite a nice illustration that, beyond the media interest, which was fun, had its own challenges, it was actually making a difference, at least to some policies that would help our patients.
Mm. One possible explanation was that they are a vulnerable group, period. They're going to be both vulnerable to mental health difficulties and vulnerable to COVID. It's not necessarily that the mental health difficulties make them more vulnerable to COVID.
Well, you're right. It absolutely could be either of those. And
yes.
So, simplistically, one view is that whatever your biology is that gave you the mental health disorder or vulnerable to that, the same biology might make you vulnerable to COVID. So, for example, brain inflammation, to take a simple concept, if you like a biological link between those two things. On the other hand, we know that people with particularly serious mental illness have different lifestyles, they're less healthy generally, they may have higher body mass indexes, they smoke more, they may have more problems isolating, etc., etc. So my own view is it was more likely to be something about the behavioural correlates of having a mental illness than really a direct biological link. And in a way, the same question about is the link about biology, or if you like, sociology, applies to the fact you get more mental health diagnosis after COVID. Is it that the COVID virus has directly done something to you that has made you vulnerable to develop depression or anxiety, for example? Or is it having had what could have been a life-ending illness has left you feeling traumatised in a psychological sense, and this the diagnoses just reflect that? So again,
and that's still an open question.
Yes, it is. There's data beginning to come through that may shed light on that, but one of the, if you like, the limitations of electronic health records research, you can only really answer questions that have been coded in the medical records, and I don't think we haven't yet worked out a way that we could do that dissection of etiology of causes effectively.
So another phenomenon that you've looked at, which again has been in the media a lot, is what's come to be known as long COVID, the idea that people have impairments to their health that can hang around for a year or more. What did your network studies show there?
Yes, so that was a much more recent paper where... We looked at what were really essentially a group of nine sort of cardinal features of long COVID. One of the challenges of researching long COVID is nobody knows what it is. It's sort of a rather circular argument. But we captured nine what we thought features that captured most people's views about the common things in long COVID.
The key ones were,
things like ongoing breathlessness, ongoing aches and pains, fatigue, brain fog, etc. So we had nine things like that. And again, in the 6 months, or particularly in the 3 to 6 month period after COVID. So we're trying to now not look at the acute symptoms. We're looking at people who've 3 months later, then what happens in the next 3 months. What percent of patients have been diagnosed with one or more of those nine core long COVID features?
And were these people all hospitalised or were they?
No, this is everybody who'd happened. By this stage, we're talking about over 250,000 patients with COVID. That's what pandemics do to your sample sizes. They go up every time you look.
And they were all in the network?
They were all in the network. In sensitivity analyses, we compared people who'd been hospitalised with those who hadn't, patients who'd had to go to ITU and those who hadn't. So we had measures of severity. But the bottom line is, we found quite high rates of one or more of the long COVID features in everybody who'd had COVID, not just those who'd been ill enough to need hospitalisation or intensive care. On the other hand, we also found, we did the same comparison again after influenza to try and control for having a virus or being ill during the time, and rates were pretty high after influenza. And so, depending which statistic you pick on, we found that roughly maybe just over half patients after COVID have one or more of these long COVID features. But so did, as I recall, almost a third of people after flu. And interestingly, this paper again generated lots of media interest. Interestingly, this time, the thing most media picked up on was the flu findings and started talking about long flu, which actually is quite an interesting different take on long COVID, because it just highlights that we've actually known that all viruses can lead to persisting physical and
emotional. There was something called post-viral fatigue syndrome.
Somehow people thought COVID was unique and long COVID was something we've never seen before. Our data, I think others suggest, well, there probably is something a bit different about it. On the other hand, there's also a lot that's similar. And I think at that point, they get into the politics of long COVID and this kind of, it's because it's almost being defined by the people who are experiencing the symptoms. It's a user-led movement. That, I think, poses challenges for trying to do unbiased research where you don't have fixed views about what it is or what it isn't. So we just, in this paper, we just presented a lot of data in as neutral a way as we could and almost leave other people to interpret what they want from our findings. Yeah.
So you mentioned you were also looking at how simply living through the pandemic, whether or not you had the illness, affected people's mental health. And one of the instances you looked at was eating disorders, but were there others as well? And how common did this turn out?
So you're right. So we've done that, and the eating disorders is the only completed study of that kind, where now we're using the same health network, but we're now not looking at people particularly who've had COVID. We're now looking at the whole population. So this is more, again, the question of what has the pandemic done to everybody's mental health? And the reason we picked eating disorders was because, again, by the time we decided to investigate this question, which was probably spring this year, spring 2021, there was quite a lot of anecdotal evidence that eating disorders were becoming commoner and apparently worse. So a lot of clinicians, both locally and in other centres, both in the UK and abroad, were reporting not quite an epidemic of eating disorders, but really a noticeable increase, and some of the data that were coming through nationally were supporting that. So we again thought we would look at this in a research way using this network. So we looked at the rates of a diagnosis of different sorts of eating disorder through 20, essentially looked back through the last 4 years. And as you might expect, until the pandemic came along, the numbers were pretty constant from 1 year to the next, and we didn't really change from 1 month to the next within a year. And then as early 2020 began, suddenly the diagnosis, this is now measuring first diagnoses of eating disorders, the numbers start to go up, and they go on up and up, and so by the end of 2021 they're still going up, and by the end of 2020, beg your pardon, it was almost double what it had been the previous year. And so that was your support from this real world data, that the anecdotal evidence was probably right, there were more people being diagnosed with eating disorders. They did appear to be more severely ill, in that a higher proportion of them were attempting suicide, which is quite a useful proxy for severity, as you can imagine. But also, interestingly, it wasn't just any eating disorders, but particularly anorexia nervosa, in some ways the most serious form. Mm. And also it was teenage girls, so other ages and men were much less affected. So it would appear there was something that was affecting teenage girls with anorexia that was being most stirred up by the pandemic.
And again, the data doesn't tell you why that might be, where you need to
It doesn't.
You do a different kind of study.
You do, and other people who are interested in eating disorder themselves have done quite a lot of interesting now, both qualitative and quantitative studies, trying to drill down into that. And as you might imagine, my reading the data is it's a mixture of things, everything from the social isolation to the pressure to the need to retain control in one aspect of your life when the rest of your life you've lost. You can imagine all sorts of plausible and probably correct mechanisms, but that's not something our studies have tried to answer.
Mm-hmm. So have the, we talked a little bit about this before, but do you think the findings that have come out of these big studies that you've done have already changed policy or practice, or do you think they will in the future?
Well, I mentioned an example probably of the prioritisation of patients' mental illness with
yes.
vaccines and all that. Beyond that, it's difficult to say. I mean, we have been told that a couple of our papers have certainly been discussed, by, say, both by UK policymakers and in the US, interestingly. Another study we did, which was about the risks of the nasty blood clots with the vaccines we got
yes.
involved with.
Yes, sorry, we should have talked about that.
Well, so that got us into a whole different interesting area where the different sort of vaccine manufacturers obviously and different people were putting spins on the data because, of course...
Well, let's go back and sort that out before we go any further. So,
okay.
So this is... I can never remember what CVT stands for. I know the T's thrombosis.
Cerebral venous sinus thrombosis.
Right, yes.
So this, again, went to a time when this was very much in the forefront of the media, the particular concerns about the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine.
So there'd been a small number of cases blood clot, essentially brain blood clot.
Exactly.
After the vaccination.
And as a result, various countries, including the UK, were introducing or considering introducing various restrictions on the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine, with obviously both the risks and the benefits that slowdown might produce. And so again, we thought, well, is this network the place to look at that? Now, we couldn't really directly answer the AstraZeneca question because the Americans didn't and still haven't licensed that vaccine. So within our database, we were really trying to answer the question, what was your risk of getting this nasty thrombosis if you happened to catch COVID? And how did that compare to the estimates of the risk after the vaccine? And we found, and again, other people have subsequently confirmed this, your risks of one of these blood clots is markedly increased if you get COVID. And that risk is greater than any of the estimates of how great the risk is after any of the vaccines, even amongst the young, healthy people in whom there's greatest concern that the risk-benefit equation might not be in the right direction for the vaccines. So our data got picked up, I think, rightly to say, well, whatever you worry about having the vaccine, you should be worrying a lot more if you catch COVID. And don't think just because you're young and fit, it wouldn't happen to you if you got COVID, because it still might. So that was really the message of the paper. But of course, as part of that, we also did report that in this particular data set, there were, I think, a couple of cases where this particular sort of blood clot had been reported in people having had one of the mRNA vaccines, the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine. And that got picked up because at the time, the claim was those vaccines did not cause this blood clot ever, essentially. And so people got, I think, inappropriately sort of focused on that minor point in the paper, I say, which transformed into some sort of interesting conversations. But I think now, again, the data subsequently show that these things, and anything can happen if you give 100 million doses of a vaccine to people. Some things will happen that are very extremely rare, and the message remains the same. It's COVID that is worse for your blood clots, not the vaccines.
Yes, and as it is worse for them. Pretty much anything.
Yes. So as an aside, my personal experience that was, first of all, there were concerns that what a psychiatrist doing writing about opining about vaccines, which was a fair enough criticism. There was also the suggestion in a couple of places explicitly that we, as Oxford researchers, were trying to defend the Oxford vaccine. Now, I had at the time never spoken to Andy Pollard or anybody else in the vaccine centre. So, but again, it was hard to prove that we were not in any way trying to defend the Oxford vaccine. But again, that was all a storm in a teacup, really, and died away very quickly.
So, one thing I meant to ask before I asked all those questions was whether you needed to raise funding for your research from new sources.
No, we didn't. The other attraction of this was, at least in the first instance, because I had access to this network anyway, and really all it requires is then me and Max and other people to spend their time
sitting
at a terminal, downloading and setting up the right search question and downloading the data and interpreting them. No, it didn't require a penny. The only funding, in a way, is that Max, who's an ACF, had his research time funded by the NIHR, so we're able to use his research time for the purposes of research, again, within our biomedical research centre, which is the NIHR-funded infrastructure. We were instructed to be in the pandemic, in a sense, drop what you're doing if you can do something more valuable for the COVID fight. So I think we were totally appropriate in our decisions to kind of reroute his time and sort of mine to these studies.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we covered a little bit of this. So, just going back to the first lockdown, how did it change? How did it impact on what you were able to do? Did it change the way you worked? And were any of those changes positive? You've already talked to me about how using a remote consultation with patients was something that you are probably going to do more of. But were there other things? Are there any anecdotes you can remember of?
Well, at a data level, it completely changed my life. I did for most people. I was always an academic who was here from late till early till late every day. I didn't tend to work at home instead of coming to work. So suddenly, there I was at home. Being grateful the broadband was okay for me and my wife and others. So that was logistics. So suddenly, I was, like everyone else, getting used to the Zoom and the Teams and getting used to two-dimensional images of people and all those joys that we've all learned to love. I think seeing patients, my first experience of my first time doing clinic work through both phones or Teams meetings was, in the early stages, quite an eye-opener, because you thought, this is going to be so difficult and it's not going to work. But as I said earlier, that actually was okay. But that was a big change. And of course, the last thing was wearing my academic hat, all the normal research activities and the normal teaching just stopped. So instead, we sort of filled the gaps with what we've been talking about to do with COVID and different respects.
So the students were sort of shoved to one side, were they?
Yes, so the medical, so obviously the students do their psychiatry in their penultimate year of their medical course, and pretty much that the term got the medical school basically closed for term. We also got involved though in helping support, if you remember, the medical students were due to qualify in August of 2020 and then go onto the wards as junior doctors. Because there was this desperate need for more personnel, they had their finals essentially brought forward. They lost all the usual fun of the last few months of being a medical student, and they were being kind of invited, and they were volunteering, like people volunteering for the front line, to go and be sort of quasi junior doctors from April onwards. And so I and some colleagues got involved in kind of mentoring and supporting the mental health of these students, who got both to experience, both had to deal with what was at the time, frankly, the fear of going into an environment where nobody quite knew just how deadly this virus was. They'd imagining themselves being a doctor from the beginning of August. Suddenly, 4 months earlier, they were going to be pitched in. So they had understandable concerns, and so we tried to sort of mentor them and support them through that 3 month period before they then became, if you like, proper junior doctors in August. So that was another interesting aspect of the early pandemic.
And was that something you had to do more broadly for colleagues at all levels to be aware that they might be struggling a bit with their well-being and would need support?
Yes, I suppose so, although it was very much the medical students we actively kind of sought out and offered them support, and we had these regular Zoom, not therapy groups, but support groups, if you like. I think most of us, the more senior people, there was a certain sort of Dunkirk spirit, if you like. It was the dumb thing to show you were struggling, even if you were. I think those sort of looking after ourselves, our own mental health, came in later, really, when I think we realised how long this was going on for. I think in the beginning, probably just speaking for myself, it was stiff upper lip time, absolutely.
Yes. And do you think that had a cost?
Yes, I do. I think this pandemic has affected people within university very differently from each other, like it has outside. And there's been some of us who've been very fortunate, both in our physical and mental health, and our kind of our life, our living circumstances, that have enabled us to adapt remarkably well, I think, and in some ways have benefited. I also know colleagues who, for one reason or other, whether it's where they live or childcare or physical health, where it's been a really tough period. And I think every time we have thought we're out of it, And then, of course, there's been another wave, and it's all gone on longer. I think it's been really difficult for people to maintain the sense we had in the beginning was this was an acute crisis, and we just got to knuckle down and get through it. And then it becomes a chronic thing, and I think that transition is something, again, some people find quite emotionally hard to cope with the lack of certainty at all about when it's really going to be over.
Mm-hmm. You're being very third person. Is that do you think you count yourself among those who cope better perhaps than some of the others?
Yes, I do. I mean, there'd be inconveniences for me, but I'm not sure how many other people I know have had a much more difficult time.
And did you haven't actually had COVID yourself,
have you? No, yeah. I've never had it.
But have you felt threatened by it? The possibility of catching it being a concern?
No, to be honest. I mean, it's been a time where I think knowing the statistics has been quite reassuring, and just looking at, so well, for a man of my age and weight and race, etc., my general health, what are my chances of getting really ill if I catch COVID? And it was sufficiently low that I was able to put it to the back of my mind, but I was much more worried about, you know, I might give it to an elderly parent or an elderly friend. So, yes, of course, but no, I've never personally felt vulnerable. Maybe I should.
So were you involved at all in your institution's COVID regulations or preparations or safety regime?
Only as a member of the senior management team of my department, we had, again, weekly sort of bronze group meetings when the departmental regulations and guidelines were being agreed. What did we think was right for our staff? Because the university, I think we were expecting there to be like a central, you know, diktat about what would and wouldn't happen. Although there were guidance, it was left to departments to tailor to their particular circumstances. And we, like other medical departments, have the particular complication way that we're on an NHS hospital site, even though we're a university department. And of course, the regulations for university and NHS at times have been very different. And we've tried to negotiate an appropriate some balance between following the different rules that we might be seen to be subject to. I think, again, that's worked very well. We've got a great department leadership and administration here, and all the decisions I've been involved with, I think, have been the right decision, the right balance between being too cavalier and being too cautious.
And do you think that's a general feeling within the department, or were there conflicts?
Well, again, it's been surveyed, I mean, in anonymous surveys at least twice, I think, during the pandemic. And as you might expect, there's a range of views from people who think we should have been more cautious, and nobody should have been under any pressure to come back into work almost ever, through to people who are just chomping a bit and say, it's bad for my mental health to be stuck at home. I want to come back into work. So I think on balance, I think we've got the right compromise. And again, I think there's been a lot of flexibility in individual circumstances, and from the cases I'm aware of, I think the management team, the department's done a pretty good job in trying to take on board individuals' wishes and fears and so on.
Do you think the fact that you were able to work on something that affected everyone in the country helped to support your own well-being in a funny kind of way? I mean, you had a lot of purpose in your life.
That's a good point. I'd never thought about it. I think you're absolutely right. Yes, I do think so, because I remember again at the beginning the sense of guilt, but the sense of, as doctors and as academic doctors, we should be contributing, we should be doing something and having the opportunity to do it through this way. And when it began, it never occurred to me it was quite going to take off the way it did. And particularly, I'm from a medical family, my wife's a GP, for example, so I was living at home with my wife, going to care homes and basically telling these people they were going to die and the hospitals wouldn't take them. I mean, she still has a far harder time at the kind of front line of this fight than I did, so I've always felt more fortunate than the other doctors I know.
Have you at any point throughout this, or you know, either before or since, been directly involved in any kind of policy making in around public health?
No, so we've contributed our data. I've been involved in various sort of seminars and meetings where our data, amongst others, have been discussed. For example, the Department of Health, for example, but I've never directly engaged in any specific policy that's come from any specific finding we've made. It's been more just setting the scene of the kind of scale and nature of the problems that people might be anticipating.
We're slightly nervous about asking people what they think about the government, but do you think the way the authorities, let's put it that way, have handled the pandemic as a whole has made things easier or more difficult?
It is hard not to be political and party political about this. I think it would be judicious to say. I think they've done some things well, perhaps more through chance than design. I mean, I think clearly the rollout, the discovery of the rollout of the vaccines has been a spectacular success, and we can quibble a bit around the edges, but fantastic job. How much the politicians should take the credit for that, I don't know, but that's been great. I think other things, it's very easy with hindsight. For example, things like, you know, when should the lockdown have started? I remember at the time not being aware of any evidence to know whether it was too soon, too late, or about right. So I think we've got to be careful we don't judge people against, say, with hindsight, against a pandemic where by its nature you have no idea really what's going to happen next. I think there's other areas where the culpability has been greater. You know, seeing people on the wards with no PPE available because there was no PPE for a psychiatric hospital, for example. My daughter is a junior doctor again, was nursing known COVID patients with no PPE because the hospitals didn't have it in the beginning. She got COVID, she was fine, but you know, that to me was the bit that was always, I thought, really, really unnecessary. If we'd planned for this, we hadn't got rid of our stocks of PPE, for example, we could have done a better job at probably having lower infection rates, particularly health staff catching it from one patient and then therefore giving it to somebody else. It wasn't just the healthcare staff you worry about, it's them as, you know, as vectors of transmission.
Yes, yes.
So I think it was the PPE and the whole thing about masks and the confused messaging that they gave. But, you know, like I said, it is very easy to be, use hindsight, and I was glad I was never asked to make those decisions because I think it was, you're on a hide and do nothing.
Mm. So has the work that you've done just over the past year raised ideas for things you might want to explore in the future?
Yes, so we're involved, I'm involved directly and indirectly in the two of the big now follow-up COVID studies that have been funded in the UK. There's one called FOSP-COVID and there's one called COVID-CNS. So the UK, the ICRI, the NHR and MRC have funded these two big cohort studies where they're following up people, either people who were simply needed to be hospitalised for their COVID and they're following up for a year, about 5,000 patients. Just to kind of see the natural history.
So these are UK patients?
These are now real UK patients in
yes.
real UK hospitals.
Yes.
And that study's about 6 or 9 months in, and with colleagues, there's a brain health working group as part of that. So there's some sort of measures of mental and brain health embedded in that big study. And those findings are sort of beginning to trickle out, and the bottom line is the data look quite similar to what we had reported in the US. So in the British population, again, a rather worrying proportion of patients who were hospitalised for COVID are not better at 6 months. Significant number, both in terms of how they report themselves, but also in objective measures of persisting dysfunction of one or other organ system. Then there's another study called the COVID-CNS, which is really focusing on patients who did have neurological psychiatric problems during the acute infection. And our data, I think, one of the things which helped inform what were the priorities for measurements in that study, and we're now Oxford, one of the centres recruiting to that study, where again, patients are being followed up to see both what happens to their mental health or their neurological health, what do brain scans show, what do blood tests show, to try and get a better understanding on the mechanism, as we were talking about earlier, how much of this is a direct link to the virus, how much is a direct link to inflammation, how much is not a direct link to anything. And that study, again, is just running through at the moment. So those two studies have definitely, I think, followed on from the work we did. And then thirdly, there's some other funding we put in where we were approached by a charitable foundation in the UK who'd seen our work and others and then said, you know, what could you do with another pot of money?
Nice.
So which we're waiting to hear the outcome of that. And
yes.
That would include, amongst other things we would do with that money, is again to explore more deeply into this and other health records networks to really try and produce even more big scale, robust and longer term data. Because our studies at the moment have only looked at the first 6 months after COVID. We can now look at 12 and then 18 months, and there's now almost 1 million people in this network.
Mm.
So, in a sense, this work, the results become quite outdated very quickly, because it's possible that the numbers we found in our first study, which was during the first wave, might be very different now. The public's perception of what COVID means is different. It may be that your likelihood of getting long-term problems has either gone up or gone down from the beginning, because...
Well, the virus has changed.
And the impact of vaccination.
In
fact, our latest studies are still under review. We've looked at that latter question. So does if you catch COVID having been vaccinated, is your COVID different than if you catch it without being vaccinated? Because that's another very topical question. And again, the headline of that study is, most people, like everybody, confirms that you're much less likely to get bad COVID if you've had a vaccine than if you haven't. However, your chance of getting the longer term consequences like the long COVID symptoms in our study don't look any lower. So you still seem to get those complications even though your acute COVID wasn't quite as bad. Now, there's, again, there's different interpretations of that which we need to drill down into.
Have you used UK Biobank at all? I just wondered, given that they've got that, I don't know whether they've got a better level of baseline measurements than the American network.
No, we haven't used Biobank, although colleagues at the John Radcliffe have looked at, particularly at how your brain changes because there are pre and post brain scans. Other people are using, in Oxford, are using some of the UK equivalents of the network we've used. There's two or three big primary care databases, one called Open Safely that has had a lot of publicity recently, where people have sort of asked the same sort of questions using UK data. And I think the message is UK and US give you very, they have complementary strengths and weaknesses. Mm. The great thing in the UK, of course, is it's the whole population. Mm. Whereas in the US, the level of detail that we can access is greater than you can in some of the routine UK data sets. Mm.
But even moving on from COVID, and one thing that strikes me very much is that you've got an opportunity here really to look at connections between mental and physical health in a way that you might not have done before, although you said you had already started working with them.
No, I think that's right, and I think actually that one of the things the pandemic have done, again, has drawn attention to this fact we talked about earlier, that we've always known that physical illnesses and mental illnesses are connected, particularly people after viral infections, for example, and yet it's somehow an area that's quite fallen into disrepute, but I think people have found it so difficult to unpack and make progress in. It's never really been given the attention it deserves.
Well, a lot of people thought it wasn't real, didn't they?
Well, they think it wasn't real, or they have such strong views about what they think it is or it isn't. I mean, we see, for example, yesterday's changes to the NICE guidelines about people with chronic fatigue syndrome, where there are views that this is very, very physical and it's caused by a specific thing and we must or must not do the following in people who've got it. And you've got other people who have very different views about what it might be and what we should or shouldn't do about it. And COVID, in a way, whether we like it or not, is drawing renewed attention to that question. And so I think it's a real opportunity to kind of reset things in how we do explore the relationship between mental and physical health. Mm. Definitely. Real opportunity.
That almost recapitulates the last question I was going to ask, which is, has the experience of COVID and doing all this research changed your attitude or your approach to the work that you do? And are things that you'd like to see change in the future?
I think it is this integration of physical and mental health care and views about models of types of disease is the biggest opportunity. Whether that's really going to happen or not, I think is unfortunately still a moot point. For a number of rather annoying reasons. One is that in this country, we have a separation of physical and mental health care. So most of the trusts where secondary mental health care is provided are separate from physical health care trusts. And so getting good psychiatry in general hospitals and good general medicine in psychiatric hospitals is much harder than I think everybody thinks it should be. And yet trying to unpick that historical separation has proved problematic over many years, whether COVID will be enough of a stimulus for that. For example, in these non-COVID clinics that are being set up, I think we all want it to be, but quite where the levers are that are needed to change it meaningfully is remains to be seen. And I think from a research point of view, again, it'll be whether convincing research applications get funded that do manage to cross that boundary. Too many of them seem to fall by the wayside because either the physical bit isn't done well enough, or the mental bit isn't done well enough, or the funders don't like the combination. So I think it's those issues rather than anything sort of more fundamental about the need to change things and integrate these areas of research and clinical practice that we need to be considering.
Great. Thank you. So continuing to talk to Paul Harrison, you mentioned briefly, but I rather ran over it at the beginning, that you'd actually been involved in volunteering to carry out vaccine clinics. How did that come about?
Yeah, so again, early in the pandemic, when we were all looking as doctors, how could we contribute? And then the vaccines came along. There was obviously the opportunity for doctors to get involved in vaccinating. Now, as a psychiatrist, I do very little in the way of practical procedures, I haven't done for many years. I trained in giving the vaccines, and I've been running participating in vaccine clinics in general practice since the first wave. We're now running the booster clinics, and actually that's been really rewarding.
So how much of your time in a week do you spend doing clinics?
Probably averaged, maybe only a clinic, a clinic every week, maybe a clinic every 2 weeks, so that's 60, 70 patients usually in a batch. And that's been really interesting, both in terms of, you know, face-to-face with people who are living through the pandemic and are having the vaccines, and you'd expect all the hopes and the fears and the worries about people coming for vaccines, everything from, will this vaccine give me a blood clot, to, you know, can my friend have it while she's sitting in the waiting room? So there's all those kind of real-life engagements. The vast majority, it's actually been a very positive experience for me, partly, again, feeling I'm doing something useful, but also 99.9% of the people are so grateful. They really understand what a triumph the vaccines have been. They're very proud to be British, and being an Oxygen, they're very proud of getting the Oxygen. I remember in the first wave, it was all, can I have the Oxygen? Is this the Oxygen? And, so obviously 50% of the time it wasn't, 50% of the time it wasn't. It was kind of random which you got. So that's been good. Kind of sort of felt a certain pride about being at least at the institution that developed the vaccine, although of course I have no credit whatsoever for the vaccine itself. So that's been quite fun. Again, seeing people appreciating it. And then as people come back for their second dose and now for their booster, you sort of see again how the population's views about this whole thing is evolving, like we talked about earlier. It's gone from being this brand new, exciting, but really scary thing through, oh yes, I better have my booster, and I'm hoping to go on holiday, and can I have my passport, and those sorts of things. So again, it's seeing the evolution of, if you like, the societal implications of the pandemic coming through, whilst doing something sort of practical and appreciated. So that's been, I have found that rewarding.
Good. Oh, I'm happy about that.